Chapter 10. That night, as Al Miller sat across the dinner table from his wife, the terrible thought came to him again and again that Chris Harmon was a completely reputable man, not a swindler at all. He offered me that job, Al thought, to rehabilitate me. "I've got some news," he said to Julie at last, breaking his mood of introspection. "I got offered a job." At once she said alertly, "What job?" "For $7.50 a month," he said, "plus expense account, and that's just starting salary."
$750? She said, her eyes wide. "Tell me about it. What do you have to do? Who is it?"
"A phonograph record outfit," he said. "It would be public relations." His tone was so gloomy, so resigned, that her face fell. "It's just a fluke," he said. "I'm not qualified for it. I'd last about 2 weeks or 2 days." He continued eating.
"But why not take it?" Julie said. "Maybe you're wrong. You know you're always so pessimistic, and you just sit around and let things happen. This job falls in your lap, and you just sit there. You don't exert yourself."
"I exerted myself," Al said. "I went out and got it."
"Then you must think you can do it," Julie said. "Isn't that logical?"
"You're just having doubts, your usual doubts. I know you can handle it," Al said. "He just offered me the job because he felt sorry for me."
He could not rid his mind of the idea. It had been there ever since he had left Teach Records.
"What did you tell them? You didn't turn it down, did you?"
"I said I'd consider it," he answered. "I said I'd tell them by Monday morning."
That gave him 3 days.
"All right," Julie said in a brisk, practical voice. "Suppose they do just feel sorry for you. What does that matter?" Her voice rose. "It's still a good job. It still pays well. What do you care about their motives? That's paranoid."
She gestured excitedly with her fork.
"What's the name of the place? I'll go down and talk to them. I'll phone. That's what I'll do. And say I'm your secretary, and you've decided, after long consideration, to accept the position."
The whole world's mad, Al thought. It's all sham.
"If you have the gumption to go out and rustle up a high-paying job opportunity," Julie said, "you have the gumption to take the job and do good at it. They wouldn't offer it to you if they didn't have faith that you could do it. Take it, or Al, I'm not exaggerating. If you turn it down, I know myself, and I know I'll react by considering that you won't have been loyal to me. We took marriage vows. You're supposed to honor and obey me."
"It's hard to obey in this case," he said.
"Not obey here," she said, "but honor and respect by taking a decent job so that we can have children and do all the other things we want to do and deserve to do."
Her voice had become harsh with anxiety. He recognized the tone.
"Don't let me down again, Al. Please don't give way to your neurotic anxieties. Promise me."
"Oh, we'll see," he said.
It seemed to him that he had suffered some crushing defeat by being offered a straightforward, worthy job at a good salary. And now this reaction, this sense of things having gone wrong, began to worry him. On the surface, his reactions did seem odd, to say the least. Maybe Julie was right. Maybe now that at last someone had decided to have confidence in him, to take a chance on him, his own inner sense of worthlessness had begun to emerge. He was as neurotic as Julie said. It was true.
"Defeat or success, it's all the same to me," he decided. "It's all a grind, a snare, and a delusion. Who wants it? Either one."
"You're afraid," Julie said, "to stick your neck out. If you fail, then you'll sink even deeper into apathy. You're conscious of that. You have that much insight. You'd prefer to stay as you are because the risk of failure is so great. It has such dreadful consequences to you. Isn't that so?"
"I guess so," he said.
"So you'll just go on like you are forever, drifting, getting nowhere, Al."
She faced him with a stony expression.
"I really don't know if I can go on. I just don't know. I want to, but I can't.
I really think I can't if you let me down again here.
He grunted a meaningless response. After dinner, he dropped over to Tootie Doolittle's apartment. Both Tootie and his wife were home. They were cleaning the burners of the kitchen stove. Newspapers had been spread out everywhere. The sink was filled with soapy, gray, gritty water. Seating himself out of the way, Al discussed his job prospect with Tootie, who listened carefully to all the details.
Maybe it's a front,
Tootie said when Al had finished. That idea had not occurred to him, and it cheered him up. It put an entirely new interpretation on the situation, on the job offer and on Harmon.
Maybe so, Al said. You mean they still don't want to give me the real dope? They're still holding up a smokescreen. Sure. They're going to break it to you after you've worked there a while, after they know you real well. That's natural.
He went on to recount to Al the details of a job he had had driving a woman around who ran an abortion mill. It had been months before he had out that it was not a Swedish massage place. They had kept it from him as long as possible. He then took Al off into the other room so that the two of them could talk in private.
There's one thing you may be missing, Tootie said. I happen to know about Teach Records because of my interest in music. They got a good catalog, but you know why they call themselves that name? They are a pirate label. What's that? Al said. They stole their master discs. I mean, they pirated the original records and dubbed from them. They got no legal right to the masters they press from, but they always pick something where the company is out of business and the artist dead and so on. Or some foreign label. Anyhow, Teach was a pirate. That was Blackbeard. His name was Edward Teach.
I see, Al said, pleased. I didn't make the connection.
So there's no doubt they're up to that,
Tootie said.
So maybe this one fact enough to make you more cheerful. You obviously feel only somebody doing something crooked is going to pay you almost $800 a month. If they honest, they're not going to pay you anything hardly at all. That's because you know perfectly well down deep inside you, and I say this from being a friend of yours and knowing you pretty well, you know you're not worth anything.
You want your block knocked loose, Al said.
I knock your block loose right back, Tootie said. Now listen to me. You not worth anything because you got nothing to sell. You like a lot of colored boys who come up north to cities from the farmland in the south. You come up from a farm town up in Napa County. You more like those boys than you know. I know, though. I see a lot of the same things in you as in them, but you're too ignorant to recognize that. I mean ignorant of what I happen to know, although you plenty smart in other ways. Here, all they gotta sell when they come to town, their work. Laboring somewhere, like in the Chrysler plant, or driving a truck, or putting on tires at Monkey Ward. Why anybody pay them anything? Why you pay them? You hire them to wash your cars on your lot for you, if you had any money. Other lots do that. Other lots have a colored boy. You so poor, you your own colored boy.
So what? Al said.
So other people not going to go on like that, Tootsie said. They want to rise and be well-to-do, so they figure out something they can sell. They find something they can do somebody else want enough to pay for.
But you too dumb. You not learning nothing to do. In that respect, you different from most people, white and colored. You got to do something other people want.
Like my dog, Dr. Mudd.
He learned to bat balloons with his nose, so everybody pay to watch. He a lot smarter than you. Nobody pay you to do nothing because you dull. You miss out. You go on being what you are instead of being what other people pay to watch. Maybe when you get old, you realize this, but then it's too late. You got to assume a vivid personality. Live like you a dangerous, terrific person, like a spy or something. You got to go around create mystery.
Nobody know when you come or go or what you do. Listen, that exactly what Mr. Harmon do. He make everybody tell tall tales about him, and they not really know what he do or what he is. But they know what Al Miller. It's written all over him. Al was silent. You not got glamour, Tootie said. That it, in one word. You nothing but a ditch water walking around on 2 feet. Maybe so, Al said. Life like Ed Sullivan's program, Tootie said. I watch that every week on the TV. That the best TV show there is. Now, that Milton Berle retire. I watch these show people come up. They got no talent. That the truth. What they got is personality. Who got talent these days? Al Jolson, he never had no talent. Nat Cole, he can't sing. Frank Sinatra never could sing. Fats Waller couldn't sing. He croaked like a frog. Johnny Ray, terrible singer. Sammy Davis Jr., nothing but a big ham bone, but he very popular. Kingston Trio, bunch of college kids. But they got personality. You have to learn how to do that. I can't. You did for 1 minute when you walked into that man's office, or he not have decided to hire you. You done it once so you can do it again, and not for a second, but all the time. You live like you some French foreign agent in Tangiers. You make up stories to keep yourself interested, and pretty soon they get interested in you. If by popping a couple of those goofballs you can do it, then you don't need them. You throw away that little tin you carry. You make it alone, on your own. I know you can. And by God, you're worth $800 a month starting salary. He right to pay you. Al was silent, thinking about what Tootie was saying. I'll be frank, Tootie said. I give my right arm to be where you are now, getting an offer like that, but I never will. Partly because nobody hired colored for any big dough except in the entertainment industry, and partly because I am no talent. That's why I have to earn my living as clerk in a county department of health, writing up reports on outdoor toilets. I just a clerk. But you basically a big bullshitter. Basically, you got a line already. All you need is to get it out. I was taught it was good to tell the truth, Al said. Sure, you get to heaven by being a truth-teller. Is that where you're going to go? Is that your destination? Or you determined to live a happy life here? If the latter, you learn to give out with your line and never stop, never let down, not till you dead, then you can tell the truth. You not actually a big butter and egg man from Boise who owns 6 oil wells and be president of local chamber of commerce. Al felt thoroughly crushed. The truth vastly overrated anyhow, Tootie said half to himself. Actual truth is everybody stink. Life a drag. Everything that live going to die. Truth is, nothing worth doing. All end badly anyhow. You tell that, you doing nobody a service. Well, that's not the only side of reality, Al said. Okay, maybe not. Other side is what? You tell me. Al considered, but he could not express it. However, he knew that Tootie was wrong. Tootie was embittered. Possibly rightly so. But his outlook had been poisoned years ago by his clerical job, in fact, and his dreams of glory in fantasy. No wonder he hung around bars with Dr. Mudd, attracting attention as best he could, living it up when he could. He was right to do that. But surely there were other ways, better ways out. You're basically a bitter man, Al said. I have a feeling you hate people. You hate me? Hell, you say, Tootie said. You'd be pleased if I debase myself by becoming what Chris Harmon wants. What does he want? Tootie said mockingly. You don't even know.
Evidently you hit on it by accident for a minute. Maybe you could keep hitting on it, maybe not.
I'm not going to try, Al said.
Oh, I think finally you come around, Tootie said. If you can get your wits going and manage to figure it out. It take time, and you do a lot of talking, but you come around. Your fear is because you afraid you can't hit on it. You afraid you try and fail. What's so virtuous about that?
Al could not give an answer to the question. Perhaps Tootie was right. Perhaps he simply lacked the courage to try to tailor himself along the lines that Chris Harmon sought. The courage and the talent.
You jerk, Al said. You're eating up with envy because I got this good job offer. You're just trying to make me feel bad. You're getting back at me.
Listen, Daddy, Tootie said.
You better be careful.
I'm careful,
Al said. Careful enough not to bring any more good news to you.
Tootie said,
so it is good news. He grinned. You really tickled Pink down inside about this job. You secretly gloating away about it. Couldn't wait to get over here and tell me. Some cracker offers you $800 a month. You hardly able to sit still in your pants thinking about it, all that bread.
You really live good.
You buy Old Forester all the time pretty soon instead of that stuff the liquor store have on sale. That Colonel St. Masterson Bourbon that tastes like it come down a drainpipe from the roof.
The door from the kitchen opened. Mary Ellen Doolittle put her head in.
Listen, you boys getting a little too much carried away. Better calm down.
Okay,
Al said. Tootie nodded woodenly.
I surprised at you,
she said in her small, delicate voice.
Both of you always quarreling, and tonight both of you sober and still quarreling. It not do you either any good to stay sober, it look like.
She remained while they stared down at the floor.
I tell you what ail you, Al Miller,
she said.
I listen to everything you say through the door while I clean the stove. What you not got is you not got faith in God like you ought to. I know you two sneak out of the kitchen because you know I start talking God talk to you, but it too bad because I talk it to you anyhow, whether you like it or not. Not any grown man any good to he fellow man unless he spend time in the church at least once a week meditating on the value of the word come down to earth. You know, Al Miller, the world going to pass away and there be an Armageddon one of these days soon, and the sky roll up like a scroll and the lion lie down with the lamb.
Tootie said, Mary Ellen, you a nut. You go clean the stove and leave us alone. You worse than being married to some old grandma.
I tell you perfect truth, Mary Ellen said. It's all written down in the weekly 5-cent magazine, The Watchtower, which we witnesses put out and distribute. Mr. Miller, you not leaving here until you fork over 5 cents for a watchtower which carry the word of God in 90 languages, I think it is, throughout the world.
Tootie said, she just come out of the jungle, I think, sometimes. Like being married to a savage or something.
His face was contorted with shame and fury.
I go home, Mary Ellen said softly, bending down. One day, back to my home.
Al said, you mean Missouri?
He knew that she had been born there, had been in California only 3 years.
No, she said, I mean Africa.
The door shut then. She had gone back to cleaning the stove.
Christ, Tootie said. She calls Africa home, and she's never been east of Missouri. It's that religious stuff, that Jehovah's Witnesses. She never even met anyone from Africa, except at their meetings they have speakers from Africa who lecture.
They grinned at each other.
How about a drink? Tootie said, rising. Some Colonel St. Masterson, age 1 year. Okay, Al said, with water.
Tootie went into the kitchen to get glasses. By the next morning, Saturday morning, Al Miller had decided to take the job. As he unlocked the chain at Al's motor sales and bent to pick up his mail, he realized that the first person to tell was not Julie nor even Chris Harmon, but the old man. The doors of the garage had been opened. Jim Ferguson, as usual, was at work for at least the early part of Saturday. He would probably work until noon or one, depending on how much work had to be done. And now, Al realized, is the time to tell him. As soon as possible, now that I've decided, in view of what I said to him about Chris Harmon. Accordingly, he left his lot and entered the garage by the side door. The old man had opened it to get more ventilation and light. He found the old man in the office. Ferguson sat opening his mail. He glanced up at Al, his eyes red-rimmed, watery. In a hoarse voice, he said,
"Long time no see."
His attention returned to the letter which he was reading, so Al sat waiting.
"Any news from your doctor?"
Al said when Ferguson had finished reading the letter. Ferguson said,
"He said I had a mild heart attack."
"Hell,"
Al said with dismay.
"He's making more tests."
The old man began to tear open another letter. Al saw that his hands were shaking.
"Excuse me," the old man said. "I have to read my mail."
Taking a deep breath, Al said,
"Listen, that guy Chris Harmon, we were talking about him. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe he's not a crook at all."
The old man raised his head. He stared at Al, blinking rapidly, but he said nothing.
"I'm no judge of people like that," Al said. "That far up? I have no experience. I was relying on second-hand advice anyhow. He could be a crook. The point is, I don't know. I can't prove it either way. It's a mystery to me."
He paused.
"I was over there."
The old man nodded.
"I had a long talk with him,"
Al said.
"Oh, yeah?"
the old man murmured, as if preoccupied.
"Are you still sore at me?"
Al said.
"No,"
the old man said. "I thought it'd make you feel better," Al said, "if I came and honestly admitted that I don't know one way or another about Chris Harmon. You'll have to make up your own mind." He had meant to go on then, to the part about his asking Harmon for a job, but he did not get the chance.
"Listen," the old man said, "get out of here."
"Oh, God," Al thought.
"I'm not speaking to you," the old man said.
"I thought this would make you feel better,"
Al said, unable to grasp what was happening.
"Now it makes you sore," he said, "to have me say I don't think he's a crook."
It was the most incredible thing he had ever seen.
"Okay," he said, "I'll get out, you old nut."
He got quickly to his feet.
"You want him to be a crook?" he said. "You want to be swindled, is that it?"
The old man said nothing. He continued to read his mail.
"Okay," Al said. "I'll leave. The hell with you. You're not speaking to me. I'm not speaking to you."
He started out of the office.
"I don't get it," he said.
The old man did not look up.
"You're really addled,"
Al said at the door of the office.
"Your brains are scrambled. That heart attack must have done it. Yeah, I read in an article about that once. Eisenhower is the same way, a lot of people think. So long. I'll see you."
He unsteadily made his way to the entrance of the garage and out onto his lot.
"That's the craziest thing I ever heard of," he thought. "He really ought to be put away. His wife is right. She ought to get an attorney and have him put away."
"I can understand a man getting sore when somebody tells him he's getting swindled," he thought. "But not a man getting sore when somebody tells him he's not getting swindled. That's not human. I ought to send away for one of those mental health pamphlets and drop it into his mailbox. It's going to be hell staying around here with him," he said to himself, "working around a madman."
What a crazy world, he thought. "The old man sells his garage without telling me. He ruins my life, puts me out of business. And then he winds up mad at me, not speaking to me."
Going across the street to the coffee shop, he closed himself in the payphone booth and dropped a dime into the slot. He dialed his home phone number, and presently Julie answered.
"I'm going to go ahead and accept that job," Al said.
"Fine," she said. "What a relief. I was so afraid you wouldn't. And it really does look good, doesn't it?"
"It pays well," he said, "and it looks as if it would be interesting. Anyhow, I have to do something. I can't stick around here."
"It took you so long to see that," Julie said.
"Well," he said, "I'm stuck here with a senile lunatic. Naturally, I see it. There's nothing else to see."
He rang off, paused, and then, putting in another dime, dialed the number of the Harmon organization. The receptionist answered.
"Teach records."
I never did get to tell him, Al thought. The old man. I went over there and he didn't give me the chance. "Let me talk to the man I was talking to before," he said to the receptionist. "Mr. Gam, I think his name was."
The girl said, "I'm sorry, sir. Mr. Gam is no longer with us."
Floored by that, Al said, "I was just talking to him the other day."
"Who would you like to talk to, sir?" the girl said, "since I can't connect you with Mr. Gam."
"Well, I don't know," he said, completely at a loss. "They offered me a job. Mr. Gam had it all worked out."
"Is this Mr. Miller?"
"Yes,"
he said.
"Mr. Knight will talk to you,"
the girl said. "Mr. Gam and Mr. Harmon turned your name over to him. He's familiar with the situation. Just a minute, Mr. Miller." There came a series of clicks, then a long silence. Then at last a hearty man's voice loudly in his ear.
"Mr. Miller!"
"Yes,"
Al murmured. "This is Pat Knight. Glad to meet you, Al."
"Same to you," Al murmured.
"Mr. Gam is no longer with us. A position came up he'd been waiting for, and he flew. He made his move. That's the way it has to be. He'll be in the office from time to time. Well, you're going to join us?"
"Yes,"
Al said.
Knight said, "Well, now, listen, Al. There are a couple of things I'd better discuss with you. When Mr. Gam talked to you, he was a little confused. He had a lot on his mind, this new spot he was after. He got you mixed up with another fellow that Harmon was sending around, a Joe Mason or Marston. He never came in. This Marston, used to be a retail dealer up in Spokane. We wanted him to handle our esoteric classical for us, and Gam got you involved in that. He got you picked out for that spot. He had the idea that was what Harmon wanted."
Knight laughed.
"I see," Al said, feeling parts of his mind fade out into numbness.
They ceased to function. He merely stood at the phone, nodding his head up and down, listening.
"We do have a spot for you,"
Pat Knight said more slowly and soberly. "Listen, I'll level with you, Al, right here and now on the phone. What we need is an aggressive, hard-working young man who isn't afraid of rising above his fellows and making something of his life. Is that you?" "Sure," Al murmured.
"The profits are big," Knight said. "So's the responsibility. You'll have to be able to meet the public." "You can do that. I see by your file that you're an automobile salesman."
It occurred to Al that he should say he was not. It was not right. It had to do with a big new car agency with glass windows, new shiny cars, salesmen in striped suits standing around by potted palms. "That's not me," he wanted to say.
"I'm a dealer," he said.
"What's that?"
Knight said. "I have my own place," he said.
"I'll be darned," Knight said. "Well, you're no doubt what we've been looking for. I can see why Mr. Harmon told us to keep our eyes open for you. Well, I suggest you drop over and we'll settle this. There's been some confusion here, but we can iron it out to everybody's satisfaction. The spot we have is right up your alley, Al. I know you'll really go for it."
"What is it?"
he said loudly. "Now listen,"
Knight said in a slightly frigid voice.
"I want to meet you face to face, Al. I have to see what kind of man I'm dealing with. I can't just hand out jobs over the phone, like greeting cards."
He sounded huffy now.
"When can I expect you?"
he said in a brisk, formal voice.
In about an hour, I can squeeze you in at exactly 1:30 for about 15 minutes.
Okay, Al said. He nodded. I'll be over.
He hung up the phone and left the booth. I'm helpless, he realized.
They've got me like a bug in a mayonnaise jar. As soon as I said I wanted the job, they stabbed me. They highballed me, he said to himself. The old trade-in trick. Every car dealer uses it. Quotes the customer such a high trade-in for his car that he has to come back. He can't turn it down. And when he comes back, he discovers that the offer has been withdrawn in the meantime. A new shipment has come in, or the salesman who made the offer isn't with the firm anymore. And by this time, the guy is hooked. He's already made up his mind to wheel and deal.
Like me, Al thought. I've decided to join the Harmon organization, even though I don't know what the job is or what it pays. I know nothing, except that I've decided to make my move. It's a Mutt and Jeff act, he realized, between Harmon, Gam, and Knight. And I fell for it. I fell so completely that I'm going over there and taking the job they have, the job they had for me from the start, no matter what it is. And I think I know what it is, he thought.
It's a salesman job, selling records. That's what they mean. A flunky with a bow tie, a crew cut, a briefcase, and a glad hand stuck out. They mean me, what I'm going to be in a little while. My destiny. They saw me coming, he thought to himself as he recrossed the street to the lot. The boy from the country. The farm boy from St. Helena who has no chance, no hope in the big city of Oakland, California.
Getting into one of the lot cars, he drove home in order to change his clothes, in order to get a clean shirt and tie and suit, so that he could impress Mr. Knight.
This is how they break you, he realized. This is how they break your spirit, bit by bit. They don't come right out and make the offer. They don't look you straight in the eye and say, we've got a salesman's job for you. Take it or leave it. No! They do a snow job on you. They sell you. And why not? They're better salesmen than you are. Look where they are. Look who they are. And then look who you are. I should have known, he thought. If Harmon was smart enough to build up that organization, to have the kind of house and cars he has, to dress like he does, he's smart enough to make mincemeat out of me. I should never have tried to take a confidence man, he said to himself. Harmon knows a million tricks I never heard of. I'm an amateur. We all are, compared to him. And they know I'm hooked, he thought. They know it's too late for me to back out. I'll take the job, whatever it is. They're masters of manipulation, of using psychology. I'm their white rat, he thought. I'm in deep in the maze by now. Far too deep to get out. And the cleverer I am, the smarter I act, the deeper I go. It's fixed that way. That's part of the system by which it works. I've told my wife and my friends I'm getting a big-time job. They knew I'd say it, pass the word around. Now I have to pretend. I have to start living a lie. I have to keep telling them and telling myself that I've got a nifty job at nifty pay for a nifty outfit, that I'm going somewhere. But in fact, I'm not going somewhere. However, I have to keep that quiet. I have to keep that to myself. And the proof of how well they have me is that I will keep it to myself. I'll be smiling all the time. I'll have to be. From now on, there's no choice.